Welcome back. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to look at the question of the black world and media in this country, and it's a very complex question. It's part of the Open Society's Talking About Race series that will be taking place at the Enoch Pratt Library tonight. And we are joined here by two of the people who will be there tonight, Rashad Robinson, who serves as the Executive Director of Color of Change, the nation's largest online civil rights organization, and Stacey Patton, who is reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And before joining the Chronicle, she was senior editor and writer for the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund. And joining me in studio here as our co-host is Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of the book Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics in Africana Communities. And Stacey, Rashad, and Kimberly, welcome. Good to have you all with us here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to encourage all of our listeners here to call in at 410-319-8888 as your conversation moves you. Tweet us at Mark Steiner or comment on our Facebook pages. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do join us at 410-319-8888. One of the things that, as I was reading all the articles that you, Rashad, and Stacey have written recently, one of the things that really struck me is that when we look at media in this country and we think of the problems with race in media, you usually focus on television and TV news and the rest. But it's a much broader question that encompasses entertainment, comedy, as you've written about, Stacey, in your critique. It's about the internet and power there, and what all that means, as well as TV, the imagery that we're all surrounded by. And I think that that's part of, in some ways, I think what Black Lives Matter and the things that have happened in this country over the last 5 years, maybe since Katrina, have done, which is to bear open the depth of what we're facing when it comes to this question. It's not just a simple question of changing what a reporter does. Rashad?
You know, I agree. I mean, I think we are dealing with this issue of cultural presence versus cultural power. You know, black folks can be everywhere in the media. People of color can be seen in Hollywood, can be seen on the news, can be seen, you know, across many different platforms. But we can't mistake that presence, that awareness, that visibility for the power to actually dictate sort of how our images will be shown, to dictate that our images won't be filtered through many different corporate filters that will tell a different type of story. And so America, you know, always, but in particular in this moment, as we see sort of so much rise from comedies and dramas on entertainment to sort of how we're depicted in news, America can love black culture and hate black people at the same time. And that distinction doesn't cause any type of problems for those who are sort of in the media as a business to make money. In fact, that type of contradiction actually in many ways helps them make money. And so we are dealing with this question of presence, mistaking sort of the awareness and visibility for the actual power to ensure that those who tell our stories, those who put our images forward, are doing so with an understanding of our humanity.
Stacey, do you want to jump in and then we'll turn to Kimberly?
So thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here.
I think all those layers that you pointed out, I like to think of them as an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
An ecosystem where these various filters do their job of, perpetuating ideas and nurturing a master narrative about black pathology and failure and criminality and providing white America with a racial ego stroke that's incessant. And so whether it's film, whether it's news stories, whether it's statistics about black crime or black failure in some sort of way, each one of these is sort of mutually reinforcing when you take all of them together. So we live in a country that has this long discourse about otherness, about racial difference, and it needs to be fed constantly. And so that's what we see reflected in our popular culture and in our news media.
Yeah, I want to echo exactly what Rashad has already offered to this discussion. I often talk about in my own work that the black body is revered and reviled all at the same time, that we become this space where, as, to use a, an example, Serena Williams, greatest tennis player that we've seen in decades, some would say ever. But she becomes this space that we occupy and we revere as being this phenomenal athlete. But at the same time, we also, through the media, use her as this vehicle to cast all of our angst and frustration about the black body and how it gets represented, what her body looks like, creating tensions between her and other tennis stars, which in some respects just helps to reinforce and gives us the opportunity to believe that there is this tension, so we need to watch tennis on television. So it's all about that mechanism or that enterprise that feeds the media or allows the media to feed to us what they want us to participate in. But I also think about it in the context of the role of the economy and the fact that the black body gets used for even this political economy. I think about the example of the Disney star Zendaya back in February when she decided to go to the Oscars with faux locks in. Beautiful, beautiful. I wish mine looked as good as hers did, even in faux. But beautiful faux locks and elegant dress. But all individuals could talk about, in particular on a television show that focuses on fashion, decided to comment about her hair and the fact that she looked like she would smell of patchouli oil and that she was smoking weed. That was the context of her choosing to adorn a very natural style for a number of black men and women.
That?
Yes, on air. And so as a result of that, we had this huge kind of Twitter backlash back and forth. You know, apologies were spread around. Zendaya, in her very coiffed, dignified way, addressed the concerns around that. But I bring it up because just a few days ago, Mattel decides to create a Barbie that looks like Zendaya wearing her faux locks. And so all of a sudden, this space in which she was reviled because of this particular hair style that she was wearing on that day now becomes a space that we want to revere, because now we realize that there's money to be made behind it, that folks like Kimberly Moffitt will go out and buy it for her daughter because she finally has this image that her daughter can embrace.
I mean, I'm just thinking about what you were just saying, Kimberly, and I wonder, Stacey, if we're at a strange kind of confluence here.
What do you mean?
Well, in that, I had this conversation when I was on MSNBC recently, and with Melissa, and we were talking about where the Black Lives Matter began, and her argument started, and I started thinking a lot about it at Katrina, in terms of consciousness in America beginning to wrestle with things, not just a few years back. And that something has happened in this country where the complexity of race is coming to the fore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think a lot of that has to do with social media.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Right.
Absolutely.
If you thought you were crazy, you know, or paranoid before about race, and those of us who study and write about race incessantly, what new media has done and social media has done is confirmed what we've long, you know, knew to be true. And so we're seeing it in real time, and we're seeing it incessantly. I mean, if I log on to my Facebook page, I have probably over 11,000 people on my Facebook page, and, you know, post after post after post after post, you know, people sounding off about race, sharing stories about some, you know, ridiculousness that has happened. And I think that there are no borders and no gatekeepers in social media in terms of how we talk about these issues. And I think it is emboldening, you know, people of color and communities of color to speak their truths in a new way that's really uncomfortable, and that's giving white America, you know, a glimpse, a really hard look into how we are feeling and processing these things and making them feel uncomfortable about in the process.
And Rashad, go ahead, Rashad. Were you about to say something?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, I agree with all of that, and I think that part of that gives me a lot of fear and should give all of us a deep sort of pause for a couple of reasons. One, you know, back to my point around presence versus power. All of that is awareness, right? People posting and reposting articles, sharing, putting out information on Twitter. You know, I run a civil rights organization that uses technology and online tools that was founded with a single email after Hurricane Katrina. So very much sort of in this space of utilizing technology, but so often we mistake the sharing or the retweeting or the posting for actually moving an agenda or developing strategy or building the type of power that forces those with the decision-making authority to be incentivized to do the right thing or disincentivized to stay silent or do the wrong thing. And in so many ways, the attention or the echo chamber can allow us to lose sight of the strategy that we have to overlay to actually build long-term power, mistaking clicks for power, mistaking, you know, sending stuff out for actually sort of moving an agenda. You can do that online, and I do think that the power of whether it's an open internet that allows all information to travel at the same speed combined with this participation age and combined with exactly what's saying, is people not feeling like they're going crazy, but that they're connected with other people. All of that has to be, though, combined with strategy, has to be combined with organizing, or else we risk simply just elevating these issues to awareness level without driving the type of energy necessary to create the type of change we need.
And Rashad is absolutely right, if mm-hmm. I could just echo, is that, you know, because social media moves so fast, you can move stories, you can move ideas, awareness so fast, you know, it gives, you know, some young tech-savvy activists especially this false illusion that change also happens fast, that the kinds of organizing that we saw, you know, during the, you know, civil rights era or the kinds of fights to break down some structural barriers will also happen fast. And so then it makes sort of this, you know, door knocking and canvassing and sort of traditional mobilization seem not as sexy. And so that's also another risk that we're seeing.
And part of that political mobilization, I mean, I think that some of the work you've done, Rashad, just put out there for our listeners, you've actually, the Color of Change, and even before that with GLAAD, but Color of Change, you've been really able to push some of those issues in that way in terms of organizing and forcing some of the corporate industry to change some of their behavior.
You know, absolutely, from forcing, you know, over 200 advertisers to leave the Glenn Beck show and force Fox to cancel it because they couldn't afford to keep it on the air, not because it was going down in ratings, or forcing over 100 corporations to leave the American Legislative Exchange Council in the aftermath of it being discovered that they were behind voter ID laws and stand your ground laws. That was about, you know, the presence of those issues, but translating that to power, translating people's energy to pushing them to go to say, now you're aware of this, now here are the targets, and we're going to, like, create deliberate campaigns that move the energy of everyday people, leverage their energy, to create a domino effect. The one other thing I want to say about these corporate platforms of Twitter and Facebook and all these things that I sometimes hear people talk about that have been so great, we have to be reminded that, once again, we are operating off of platforms that are not incentivized to have a complete shift in American consciousness or a change in terms of deep power. These are corporations that Color of Change actually is campaigning against. Twitter, when we campaigned against them and forced them to have to release their diversity data, we all hear so much about Black Twitter, and Twitter has really grown off the ingenuity and brilliance of Black people, employs 2% of their staff as Black people. We dug a little deeper and disaggregated the data, and within that 2%, they included cafeteria workers and security guards and janitorial staff who were all fighting for a living wage on those campuses.
Right.
And then when we dug a little deeper, they said, you know, part of this is because of STEM, and that Black folks are not represented deeply in science and math and technology. And so we said, okay, that's interesting. So we should be investing there. But unfortunately, only 20% of the jobs at Twitter are STEM jobs. Most of them are marketing or HR. So the idea that they can't find someone in Oakland to work in their HR department is outrageous and crazy. But the question is that we're thinking of these platforms as the platforms that get us free, we've got to actually be really clear that these are tools, and the minute that we become too powerful on these tools will change how we get to use them.
Right.
And,
right.
And so before I turn back to Kimberly Says, I can hear you agreeing over the phone.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I know the personal is political, but not necessarily universal. As an individual journalist and activist who, you know, sounds off on Facebook, I can't tell you how many times I've had posts removed because I said something very critical about race and racism. So, you know, you have these, you never know who has reported your post, or if there's somebody at Facebook who has, you know, targeted you once you reach the 5,000 mark or the 10,000 follower mark, and then people are sharing your stuff incessantly, and then your content just gets removed. So, like, I'm paranoid. So I totally get what Rashad is saying, that the minute you stop posting cute pictures of your dog and what you ate for dinner, and you
That's
start
right.
talking some revolutionary stuff, they're like,
can't
like,
have
we
that.
Gotta watch her.
That's a sad truth, though. I mean, that is that. I understand. What are you going to say, Kimberly? I'm going to open the phone.
I don't post of my dog, but but you're right.
I have posted a couple times about the dog, but not often. Not often. Not often. She's just so ugly. We have to put it up there sometimes.
But I so agree with much of what is being said about in terms of this whole hashtag activism, that there is a tendency for us to be a little apathetic and consider it to be an easy way for us to get our word out or get the message out in hopes that it gets retweeted or it gets clicked and favorited, et cetera. And I do think Rashad is right that what gets missing sometimes in that level of activism is a sense of strategy, that there is a very thoughtful process behind what it is that our end goal is and how, what are the strategies and moves that we're making in order to get to that end goal. And because we are in a culture, and this isn't just about the millennials, I think it's the culture of America at this point, we're in such a space of immediate gratification that if it doesn't happen immediately in this short term, after a few protests, after a few clicks, then we do get disillusioned and aren't willing to stay in the race for a long period. That is what's necessary in order to create the kinds of changes that Rashad is mentioning about policy and about legislation. That takes a much longer period of time than just a few clicks.
So join us here, 410-319-8880. And I do want to explore a bunch of different things that I've read from the pieces that both Stacey and Rashad have written. And go back to the question of the corporate world, go back to how we covered Freddie Gray here and how it's being, things like this are being covered in oppressed communities across the country, and explore the question of is America listening, and what the media has to do with that. And but let me get your thoughts on a couple of issues first. 410-319-8888. Let's go to line one. Ernest, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ernest.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I don't know if you seen the video that happened on the 23rd of September, where a 19-year-old black male from Washington, D.C., tried to obtain some cough syrup from a pharmacy in Ricestown, Baltimore County,
yep.
with a stolen Ford prescription. He left the store, went behind another store that was a dead end. The police rushed on him with his gun drawn and shot him.
Okay, we do. So can you focus more on the media question we're talking about today?
The media is this. Nobody is covering this. Here's another unarmed black male shot for a misdemeanor not committed in the policeman's. It wasn't committed. It was a misdemeanor. He shouldn't have been arrested if the police got to him at that point. The only person that I heard that talked about it was Jane Miller when she questioned Miss Armacost, the police spokesperson. And she said, when are you going to release the tape? And she said, well, we can't release the tape because it's a homicide investigation. And the next thing is Chief Johnson said that it was justified. Now, the thing is, right. It was on tape. was shot three times. You only saw one on tape.
Right.
The
tape
nobody
was released,
is covering
though.
It.
The tape was released, and there was another young man who was also shot yesterday, was it?
Mm-hmm.
In Baltimore, in Southwest Baltimore,
yes.
Who actually was white, and who was shot by police when they said he was armed when he wasn't. So it does, I think, in some ways, you've written a lot about this, Rashad, just in terms of the way these kind of situations are covered, whether it's Baltimore or Ferguson or New York or San Francisco.
You're absolutely. And in terms of the sort of implicit bias in newsrooms that come out in terms of who's valued or not, we've also been doing a lot of training of news directors around the country, really following a series of reports we've been doing, digging deep into how news coverage is created and the impact. One example is in New York City, which is the biggest city in the country, but also the largest media market. And oftentimes for local news, it can sometimes set trends. And so we wanted to look at how they were doing in New York, a city with the biggest budget and could potentially do it the best. We looked at the four major networks. And we looked at their crime coverage for 6 months, every single night, and we tracked when they labeled a suspect by race for six months. And over the course of 6 months, we then compared that back to NYPD arrest records that we already knew were skewed because of stop and frisk and broken windows policing and sort of other aspects that we know sort of, create skewed data. Even after comparing those two sides, all the four major networks overreported black crime by 40 to 50%. That means they were showing more black crime than even the arrest records showed, and they were underreporting white crime. That meant that decisions that were happening in the newsroom on a day-to-day basis, in the aggregate, were creating a huge shift in how people were actually seeing the news. Why does that matter to the listeners? It matters because in the context of these discussions we're having about criminal justice or mass incarceration, we can't actually have fair and constructive debate if Americans are going home every single night and seeing a skewed depiction of who they're supposed to be afraid of, mm-hmm. who's our hero, who's our villain. If they're being told a story every single night while they're preparing dinner for their family about what we should be afraid of, and the news at its best is supposed to inform us and make us better citizens, that's what the news is telling us, and we're seeing that all across the country. So we've been able to create a series of recommendations and start training. But simple things that we continue to see, from police officers and departments not being seen as sources, the way my organization would be considered a source, the way my, the other guests would be considered sources if they're not checked. So a police department sends something to a local station about a suspect, and then they go on the air and read it. So what ends up happening is, a six foot, 180-pound black man is the suspect, and then the news station will go on and say that. In most major cities, that's not a description. That's not a description of anyone. That could be half the black men in the city. And so what you're doing is you're just sending a message that we should be afraid of. Instead of the news agency saying the police released a vague description and leave it at that and force police to do a better job. These are all things that we're trying to push the news media around. On the inside, while utilizing our members to campaign if they don't get it right.
So we have to take a quick break. When we come back from this break, Kimberly jumped in with a comment on this. I'm going to turn to Stacey about the stuff she's been writing about a certain comedian and comedy and race, how that affects how we look and view life and what the complexities are there. Go to the phones here for Sal and Clarence. We're holding on at 410-319-8888. And reminding you, our guests, two of them, Rashad Robinson and Stacey Patton, will be tonight at Enoch Pratt at 7 p.m. At the Central Branch as part of the Talking About Race series. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with Stacey Patton, reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Before that, she was a senior editor and writer for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, now run by our dear friend Sherilyn Eiffel, and Rashad Robinson, who serves as executive director of Color of Change, the nation's largest online civil rights organization. And I can't use the word I was going to use, but it's It's a tough and bad organization. And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. And you all are 410-319-8888. And Clarence and Jim, we're going to get your calls, but I promise first to go to Kimberly to have a response to what you heard Rashad say, then a question for Stacey, then we'll go back to the phones.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited that we're still doing work in newsrooms where we are trying to address the implicit bias that happens through express writing. I mean, but I also think about this being very much of us reinventing the wheel, because we were doing this when we came up with recommendations of the Kerner Commission report back in 1968. So here it is in 2015, we're having that same conversation. And for me, although I see value in trying to reach reporters and journalists where they are, I also think there needs to be a conversation about us having these conversations even earlier. So we need to see this happening in the few journalism schools that are still around the country, in English departments, in those media and communication studies departments and programs that are preparing to create that next generation of writers, to raise awareness of what their own implicit biases are and how that gets carried into their work and how they visualize what it is that they're writing about. I think it's too late for us to have these conversations in newsrooms with folks who are 40 and 50 and 60 years old to think that they can have these miraculous moments of the light bulbs going off saying, I've been doing this so wrong for the last 30 years. Let me reinvent the wheel. I think there has to be a different way of doing this so that we can hit dead on the fact that much of what we have learned over the years back in 68, as well as in the Color of Change study that talks about the over-reporting of Black bodies as being criminal, we have to hit that head on much earlier than when it's in the newsroom.
And Stacey, I want to come back to hear Rashad's thoughts on that, but I wanted to bring this issue up because I think the piece that that you've been writing around the issue of comedy very specifically are really important as well, because that almost gets to the heart of part of what Kimberly's saying, just in terms of what we have to get to that's behind all of this. I mean, but let me let you talk about that.
So I think the piece you're referring to is my critique of Amy Schumer.
Yes, I meant to say that. I'm sorry. Yes, Amy Schumer.
The Washington
right.
Post. So that piece was published a few months ago, and basically, you know, Schumer was called out for making statements about Mexicans, jokes about Mexicans being, you know, rapists and also good workers, even though they're exploited. And so people thought this was funny, and I didn't think so at all, particularly since during that same week that news came out, we had a presidential candidate, you know, making statements about, you know, Mexicans being rapists and criminals
right.
Entering our country. And then you had a benighted white male, young white male down in South Carolina enter a black church and tell his victims that they must die because they're raping white women and taking over the country. So this goes back to my point about, you know, how even comedy, you know, is also part of that ecosystem of ideas, of racial ideas. Now, we can't say, necessarily make a statement that says those jokes, you know, cause people like Dylann Roof or, you know, those statements by Donald Trump, you know, cause people like Dylann Roof to walk into a church and then go shoot people. But it's not far-fetched to say that these ideas, you know, feed people's hatred and stereotypes and interactions with other folks. And so my call was to even look at comedy and look at people's defense of comedy. You know, why do you want to defend being able to say the N-word? Why do you want to defend being able to, you know, make racist statements and make fun of people who are powerless? Why do we have such an embrace of satire, which really is a way to, you know, give people permission to make fun of the powerless? So my piece was really about looking at that as yet another platform for reinforcing these ideas and stereotypes.
Let me open the phones here, if I might, and then come back to our guest at 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Steiner. Thank you.
Good morning, Clarence.
I'm pessimistic about society. I don't see any hope in it. If you were to cleave the physical space into two components, the mental and the physical, so you have the mental component there where the ideas are put out there and it goes into the head that filters down into the physical in structural racism, police brutalities, and things of that nature. So where are the consequences for the perpetrators of that? Donald Trump, there are no severe consequences for what he puts into the physical mental space that comes down into the physical by racism. There are no consequences for the vehicles, the media, the person as one of your guests was just explaining how the media and local networks will skew a story to make it look bad on black folks or people of color. There are no severe consequences or challenges to unrestrained freedom of speech. You know, that's more or less a constitutional issue, and nobody's going to touch that. There should be limitations on what you can project into the mental space and what you can use the media for, and that is the government, in my point of view. Look at the consequences of Ray Rice for that act that he did, as opposed to the damage that somebody like Donald Trump can do and what he's putting out into the mental space. We have to examine those things and the idea of less than and not equal to, where one part of humanity is less than or not equal to another. Thanks, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you. I hear.
We need to question both of those situations.
Yes, Ray Rice and Trump.
Yes.
Yes. I think there's a danger sometimes that when something happens like somebody like Ray Rice, because he's African American, people can say, why pick on him? This is going after a black man. The other hand is, the other part of our society, things we have to deal with, things like misogyny and attacks on women, have to be dealt with no matter who
absolutely
makes the act. But we are afraid. We're doing the opposite with Trump. We are not attacking or be questioning, I should say. The media is not questioning his racist attacks. They are
misogynistic.
They're pushing him forward as a media star in this campaign. Part of the reason he's on the top, but they are not questioning at all. The comments he makes are taking him to task for those comments or raising questions. Oh, Stacey, I think that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think we could add Carson to that, Republican, I call it the Republican, clown car. I mean, both he and Trump are the ebony and ivory of, politics. I mean, they're both, they seem to be opposites, but they really are, perpetuating Islamophobia. They're perpetuating misogyny and racism and this idea of American exceptionalism, anti-globalization. I mean, if you really look at and listen to both of them, they're echoing each other. And Carson allows white America to say, look, this is that one black best friend, that I have, and allows them to absolve themselves for, kicking everybody else. So if you really want to be bestial toward black people, you can point to Carson and say, see, this is not true. We like Ben. So there's no overt, campaign of white racist aggression here. So I think we have to look at both Carson and, Trump together and talk about how dangerous they are. I mean, there was a lot of conversation about Trump early on, like, oh, my God, he's dangerous because he can win the Republican nomination or because he can become, president. And then folks were saying, oh, that's ridiculous. He'll never win. But every time he would say something inflammatory, he would surge in the polls. And we saw this week with Carson after he made, his statements about how Islam is contrary to the Constitution, as if the Constitution is really a Christian document. His campaign donations actually surge. So what both of Ebony and Ivory do together is they give people permission, you know, to, you know, amp up their, you know, Islamophobia, their anti-immigration sentiment, and their racist sentiment. And it's really, really dangerous, because then we also see hate crime, you know, amping up as well.
I want to throw another question out here before we go back to the phones. And Jim, you're the next caller up at 410-319-8888. You want to write to us here at talkatcentershow.org. I've got my page up, and I'll see if you've written in. As somebody who runs one of the most effective online organizations in this country, The Color of Change, and what it can do, and we realize now that this digital age, this digital world is now where people are giving their information and where a lot of debate is taking place, and people and people work through it every day, especially younger generations. It's the millennials and, as they call the new generation, the Z generation, grew up with this. One of the things I was thinking about, I think you touched on this in one of your pieces, but I'm going to think about it in a different way. We talked about, you know, how you can push the corporate world, which is a good thing. And I was thinking about the whole argument over net neutrality, since I think the internet is so critically important to the future of media. That when you have the Black Caucus in Congress and other organizations not fighting for net neutrality, and kind of doing the work of the telecom and cable industry, in large part because of the power of the industry that funds the Black Caucus and funds other organizations to millions of dollars, affecting their vote. And people don't usually talk about this because they're afraid to talk about this. That's part of the contradiction we're seeing here. Do you know what I'm saying? Or maybe you don't agree. Rashad? Did we lose Rashad?
This is Rashad. I'm sorry.
I couldn't
agree more. You know, the issue around not just money and politics, but independence in this current political environment is so, you know, critically important. You know, we don't take any big corporate money at Color of Change. We're the only national Black civil rights organization that doesn't take big corporate money. And so, you know, I mean, we're having our 10-year anniversary gala next week, and simply raising money for a gala without taking corporate money and having to turn down big checks on a daily basis, it'll be a little heartbreaking, but it's a reminder. But it's a little heartbreaking when you're heading towards the end of the year and having to pay staff. But it's a reminder. But it's a reminder of why being independent is so critical, and being just as focused on holding institutions like media and corporations accountable as we are at holding government accountable has to be our work, especially post-Citizens United and the role and power that corporations have in our world, the role that media plays, and for net neutrality, which is the principle that all information traveled at the same speed, that internet providers can't treat our internet like they're editors of the newspaper and decide what moves and what doesn't, what goes fast and what gets blocked. The idea that an organization like mine could be founded after Katrina with a single email, and we could fight corporations like Fox and McDonald's and Walmart and so many other big corporations with much bigger budgets and much bigger megaphones, but we could do that because our ideas were powerful and our campaigns were smart, is the power of net neutrality and open internet. And to see so many groups that should have been on our side fighting against net neutrality without really solid arguments, without smart sort of analysis, but simply coming out against net neutrality because they had these deep relationships with corporations. And this goes back to my point around the Twitters and the Facebooks. Those corporations will never give our civil rights organizations enough money to be free. They will never make a donation to our organization that allows us to undo the structural inequality that holds Black people back. They will give us enough money so we can throw fancy parties and to distract us from sort of the true work ahead. That's what they will give us enough money for. And this is not to say that corporations in and of themselves are bad. Corporations exist to make money for their shareholders. Plain and simple. And if we don't hold them accountable as Black folks, if we don't push back against their lobbying practice, if we don't hold media institutions accountable, we're not doing the work of civil rights in the 21st century. And so to that extent of the net neutrality debate, we felt it was just as important as the voting rights conversation. It's a structural issue that allows us to organize, whether it's being able to access the polls in terms of voting rights, or with in terms of the internet, being able to access the 21st century marketplace of ideas and the 21st century marketplace of our economy, and having Black people have the opportunity to be powerful in those places and to not have our ability to be powerful focused on how much money we have in our pocket or who our friends are. And that's, you know, that's why that was so important. And you know, and just as much as we saw some many people who should have been on our side, on the wrong side, I do want to hold up the fact that many members of this Congressional Black Caucus stood up on the side of net neutrality.
Correct.
From Congressman John Lewis talking about how he wished he had an open internet during, you know, the civil rights movement, to Barbara Lee and Maxine Waters and Keith Ellison and so many Black members of Congress who spoke up powerfully. So at the same time, while I'm very, you know, comfortable holding those accountable, I do want to hold up the Black members who stood up and made their voices heard. I mean, even some of the members of the traditional civil rights community, like Reverend Barber in North Carolina, who stood up and talked about how important an open internet has been to the Moral Monday movement that he's been leading.
All important points, but I just wanted to get that out there. I thought it was important to deal with that. We often leave the internet, like we leave entertainment and comedy, out of these situations. We talk about where the media is going. I think they have to be part and parcel of this conversation. Let me go back to the phones. Unless anybody wants to jump in with a comment about that, Kimberly or Stacey. 410-319-8888. Jim, you're on the air.
Good morning. You know, what I'd just like to say is that the police department has always been a problem. I'm 80 years old. I'm a seventh grade education. I've been in business up here in Southwest for 40 years. I have owned the only Black-owned and operated cab association, and I tried to get help and support, even tried with the AFRA, and I didn't get anything. But what I want to say is this, that you can't have the minister building $16 million churches and buying $62 million planes, and you can't have foreigners coming into your city taking all the cash flow businesses, and then intellectualize why we're having all the problems. With no money circulating in the community, you have to have problems when they have problems already. Now, one thing I like about the mayor, of all the mayors in my lifetime that has challenged the police department, is Mr. Mosby and Mr. The mayor.
Okay, but go ahead. I'm only interrupting because we're not actually that. Even though we focus on this a lot, we talk about Baltimore City and local issues here, we're not actually focusing on that particular issue today, which is we're trying to kind of focus in on the question of media and race in America, because of the conversation taking place at the Enoch Pratt tonight. But if you want to have a closing thought, go ahead.
I didn't understand what you said then, sir.
I just said that we're not talking about that particular issue today.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, then. I'm done.
All right. Well, welcome back. You know, you're always welcome to call in on the show, Jim. So it's good to hear your voice at 410-319-8888. But I think that in looking at the future of media in this country and the question of race, which I think is going to change markedly. Well, let me put it this way. I don't know really where I am on this particular thought, but I'm going to throw it out as a kind of a vague thought and see if we can kind of wrestle with it for a moment. Which is that. You know, I was thinking about Rashad, what you were saying about going after the corporations, and Kimberly, your response about we can't just always go after, think about we can change the mindset of these people. We have to kind of organize politically, and think about the depth of things that Stacey has written about in terms of the power of race and what it's done in our culture. That this seems to me what I was trying to say earlier, in these last 10 years of this intense struggle in this country, which is forcing the media, whether we like the way they're covering it or not, to think and address the questions of the depth of racism in America and the rage around that, is having an effect on especially younger minds in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I think that even though it's not universal, I think it's there. And so I'm questioning what this 21st century media strategy is when it comes to race and this younger generation, because I think sometimes some of us were older, like my generation, who went through the civil rights movement, who went through all the things that we did in the 60s, loses sight of the 21st century, and we have a different kind of civil rights movement in this century. What were you about to say, Stacey?
I think one of the ways that I'm seeing a difference is in tone. And, you know, particularly from young black activists, we think back to those young black women who took the stage in Seattle.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just got up on the stage and snatched the mic and demanded to be heard. I mean, the optics of that was so powerful. Here you had, you know, powerful white male politicians on stage, you know, which was traditionally a place where black women have been demonized as welfare queens, as, you know, people who are, you know, driving up the national debt and, you know, breeding litters of children who, you know, contribute to social problems. You know, that political stage has not been reserved or a province, you know, that's welcoming to black women and their voices. And so here you had in Seattle, so-called bastion of liberalism, and these two black women got up on the stage and, you know, made their righteous rage heard, demanded that the state stop killing us. And the reaction from, you know, this predominantly all-white liberal crowd was quite frightening. And what it exposed is, well, if this is the reaction to black women's voices and Black Lives Matter and, you know, a people asserting that they have the right to exist in a space, to breathe, to live, to thrive, then, you know, what does this say about the rest of black America? And I see, you know, and since then we've had people wrestling with, you know, this idea of respectability politics and how we speak about, you know, the things that are happening to us. And I think that, you know, particularly my generation, which is under age 40, you know, we are abandoning some of those politics and saying this is not your mother's civil rights, your grandmother's civil rights movement. And so I'm definitely seeing a shift in tone in the way we write, the way we speak, and then the way we're demanding to be heard.
And I agree with that, but I also want to broaden that point by talking about how black bodies in terms of media are still not being shown in their full humanity and the complexity that comes with that humanity. And so when I think about the younger generation, the idea of millennials, the folks that I'm teaching in college classrooms, you know, their primary source of entertainment largely comes through the television genre of reality TV. And much of what we see on such programming does nothing but reinforce and re-articulate those same archetypes about black women in particular or about the black community in general. And so then it raises questions about, is there actually this opportunity where we are pushing back and doing things differently, or are we still carrying on the same way of doing business? It's just done in a different fashion because it's done in this reality setting instead of it being something that has been broadcast and produced and shown, not live, but already created for us.
But I also think, just to piggyback, and I totally agree with what you're saying here, I also think there's a growing awareness among black people that, and this is part of the rejection of respectability politics, is that no matter how we conduct ourselves, you know, no matter what we're doing, you know, whether it's a child, you know, walking home with Skittles in his, you know, pocket, or Sandra Bland going for a job interview, it does not matter how we seem to be projected in the media, we can still lose our lives. And so I think there are growing numbers of people who are, you know, not necessarily investing so much more energy in trying to prove that we're good citizens, that we pull our pants up and those other types of things, because, you know, the black body, however it is presented, is always going to be a problem.
And Rashad mentioned, there's one piece I want to get to. We're almost out of time, and I'll try to get another caller in here if we can. But I think part of the push is something you've written about as well, which is how we begin to force the humanization and depth of coverage in communities of color in this country. Rashad?
I agree with what's been said, that we can't we can't, you know, simply expect people to change in terms of their sort of deeply held attitudes through sort of, you know, our work, at least right away. What we can do is change behavior through campaign work. And we can incentivize different sets of behavior and different sets of standards. And that's exactly what we're trying to do by both doing the type of reporting and monitoring and then combining that with campaign work that deals with the bottom line, that deals with the kind of and disrupts the distribution model of how information gets into the communities. And this is a lot of work that I did at GLAAD prior to coming to Color of Change, which was really about the type of campaign work that forces institutions to change. Even if they don't necessarily change their attitudes, we change people's behavior. And then over time, by behavior shift, we can shift attitudes. And I believe that that is the work of organizing and advocacy and campaign work, and that's what we're doing at Color of Change.
We're just about out of time here, and I want to remind folks that tonight at 7 p.m. At the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt Library, Rashad Robinson and Stacey Patton, who you're listening to on this program, will dissect the ways that television, newspaper, and radio news shape stories and the way we think about them, distorts the reality of the black world and communities of color. And you can be part of that discussion tonight at 7 o'clock. I would suggest you get there early because there's usually a line that wraps around the library and you want to be able to get inside to get your seat. And you can get more information at audaciousideas.org. And before I say goodbye to my guests, I want to say congratulations one more time to a man who's a frequent guest on this show, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who just won a MacArthur and go to the way to go tea. Yeah. He just keeps rolling between Black Panther comic books and now this, and then and then also being a finalist in the National Book Awards. So I just wanted to throw that out to our listeners, let them know that that happened this morning if you hadn't seen that in the news. And I want to thank Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Rashad Robinson, and Stacey Patton for joining us this hour. Thank you three so much for
thank
being
you.
Part of the show.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank
everyone.
You.
Thank you all. And I remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers are Andrea Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Calvin Perry, and Manifa Wilson, who's with us today. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's show to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.